So I'd like to thank Anupam for this invitation, and I'm honored that he actually made it here after being a month away with his injury and so on. But so it's also a great pleasure to recognize a lot of faces in the audience, people who I haven't seen for many, many years. So the work that I'll tell you about today is some recent work that we've been doing on over the past couple of years on thinking about engineering topological phases of matter in correlated oxide materials. So this is, so of course this is, I just put together a few introductory slides. I mean, maybe it's not important, but we'll sort of go over it very quickly. So this is just about topological phases, and of course we are familiar with topology in everyday life, especially, I guess, given what's coming up in a few weeks here with the Euro Cup. And so this has genus zero, so there are no holes in the soccer ball yet. But if you visit Toronto, and of course, you know, you're all most welcome to, you know, if you're interested, you know, just write to me, and it'd be nice to visit, maybe just not in February, when it looks like this, and you have to tunnel through classical tunneling through this ice block here. And of course, if you, you know, are very tired and you decide you want to have a cup of coffee, then this is a genus one object with a hole through the handle of this cup. But of course, it's the same as having a beer, right? According to mathematicians, having a beer is the same as having a coffee. And so everything is it's sort of topologically equivalent, even though the effects may not be the same. And so, of course, you know, you can sort of go along this and say, well, you know, we can kind of have a sense for, you know, some aspects of topology in real space. And then, of course, we are familiar with another aspect that I'll touch upon in the second part of the talk, which is topological transitions, where it's here driven by temperature, or you might decide to take a bite of a donut. Okay? So you can sort of change real space topology, and we'll talk about changes in momentum space topology later in the talk. All right, so the reason we are sort of interested in this has been, you know, there is the very old and, you know, and sort of one of the first examples of topological phases goes back to the discovery of the integer and fractional quantum Hall effects, where there is a very, very precise quantization of the off-diagonal Hall conductance accompanied by states at the boundary, which are these chiral one-way edge states. More recently, of course, over the last 10 years, there's been a discovery of a number of materials which exhibit both two-dimensional and three-dimensional analogs of this, but, you know, quantum spin Hall or the topological insulators, where we have either a 2D or a 3D here system whose surface shows an odd number of Dirac fermions at the surface seen here using angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy. So the analog of the precise quantization of the Hall effect is that there are certain response coefficients in the action which have a precise quantized value in the presence of time reversal symmetry. Unlike here where, at least for the integer quantum Hall effect, there is a set of integers that sort of defines for you these numbers. Here it's a Z2 classification, which means there is either it's a trivial insulator or a topological insulator, so this theta takes on a value of either 0 or pi. And similarly, just as here, there are chiral edge states, which are one-dimensional edge states in a two-dimensional system. Here, there are an odd number of chiral Dirac fermion surface states. Okay. So people have used this to realize sort of analogs of the quantum Hall effect, but without the presence of a magnetic field. So if we think about topological insulators, three-dimensional topological insulators, very, very close to a band inversion transition, then it turns out that if you magnetize the system and break time reversal symmetry, you can drive it into a state which exhibits a spontaneous integer quantum Hall effect. So one way to think about this is, you know, to imagine if you take a general topological insulator, it'll have a big bulk gap. But if you keep making it thinner and thinner, eventually the system gets driven into more or less like a normal state, because the top surface and the bottom surface will eventually sort of hybridize with each other and just give an ordinary insulator. So the thinner you make the system, the closer you are into doing this band inversion process. And so in thin films, what people have done is to put in magnetic dopants, which upon ordering, gap out the if you want to think in terms of surface states, it gaps out the Dirac surface states. And we know that in two dimensions, if you gap out a single Dirac fermion, you get 1/2 E square over H quantum of conductance. So sigma xy in this case, from the top and bottom surface, gives us an E square over H sigma xy. Okay? And of course, this is seen here in some experiments where people have doped vanadium atoms into this topological insulator thin film, and they see sort of up to 4 digits, fairly precise quantization of the, up to 3 digits, like 3 to 4 digits, a fairly precise quantization of the Hall, in this case, the Hall resistance in units of H over E square, and also a very, very small diagonal resistance. And this, I mean, this is in ohms, but it's in units of natural units, it's 10 power minus 4. So what this allows us to realize then is, in the absence of a magnetic field, it's just this magnetic moments ordering that breaks time reversal symmetry and produces for you this quantum Hall state. So clearly, spin orbit coupling is an essential ingredient in all of this, and in everything that will follow. I'll sort of touch upon that as well. Okay. So one of the questions we would like to ask is, which is kind of what I'll discuss in this talk, is thinking about such quantum anomalous Hall effects. Can one use oxide materials or transition metal oxides to somehow think about all this physics occurring in somehow cleaner systems at much, much, much higher temperatures? So that will be one goal. And then the second I'll touch upon is some aspects of phase transitions between these kinds of, that involve quantum anomalous Hall states. Okay. All right, so when we think about momentum space topology, we are thinking of the same donut, but now in momentum space. Okay. And here, because we are in two dimensions, it's a two-dimensional torus, the Brillouin zone. And on this torus, energy bands are defined by having, at every point in momentum, I have to specify an energy for one of these bands, and I have to specify the wave function for these bands. And in a simple two-band system, which is what we'll sort of come to when we discuss the specific material realization, the Hamiltonian takes the form of some fictitious magnetic field acting on a pseudo spin half degree of freedom, which tells you up being this band and down being the other band. Okay. So the magnitude of this magnetic field gives you information about the energy dispersion of the bands, and the direction of the magnetic field tells you about the wave functions. Okay. And in particular, the direction, this unit vector that encodes the direction of this field, will move as we move in k-space. This unit vector is going to move on the surface of the sphere, and this allows us to define certain topological invariants in terms of the direction of this d vector, okay, which is the unit vector. And in particular, there's a certain topological invariant, which is a Skirmion number or the Chern number that tells you how many times you wrap around the sphere when you wrap around the torus here. So this defines an integer topological invariant, and whenever this integer invariant changes, so for example, when you go to the edge of a system or when you take the system through a phase transition, this integer invariant has to change, and that necessarily implies that you have to go through some gapless point in parameter space where the entire bulk will become gapless, or it will imply gapless edge states if you're thinking of the edge of a physical system. All right. So the reason we are, of course, interested in thinking about all this in the strong correlation setting is that we know from many, many years of thinking about a number of these correlated materials is that they exhibit, first of all, very, very interesting phases like superconductors, these strange metal phases that we know from the high temperature superconducting cuprate phase diagram. Or if you think about manganites, there are also a number of phases with different types of charge and spin order that again persists out to several hundred Kelvin. Okay? So the hope is if you can sort of put together this aspect of strong correlations and band topology, maybe one can realize two things. One is hopefully one can sort of raise the temperature scale for some of the physics that we talked about. But the other possibility is you can also get new physics maybe which comes out of this interplay of topology and strong correlations. Okay? So the kind of questions we might be interested in have to do with the fact that if you think about band topology, Then, of course, as is generic for bands in general, but more specifically for topological aspects, we are thinking about the physics in momentum space, and in particular about global properties in momentum space, whereas the strong correlation problem is, you know, very well understood in sort of a real space local picture. And really, one wants to sort of merge together these two in some fashion. Okay? So how do we bring together strong correlations and band topology in the context of materials? Can strongly correlated materials display, you know, topological bands, and in particular high temperature versions of this? Can one get new types of, you know, many body topological properties from this interplay? Does this give rise to, you know, new types of, you know, magnetic interactions in phases? So for instance, in MOT insulators, we are familiar with super exchange interaction between magnetic moments. But if you start cranking up interactions in one of these topological phases, do you get new types of, you know, magnetic interactions that become important? And finally, if there are, you know, phases that, you know, where topological phase transitions happen, is there anything interesting happening at such phase transitions? So this is the kind of general questions that are of interest, and I'll sort of touch upon some of them in this talk. Okay. So this is kind of, you know, the broadly the kind of things we're interested in, and I'll sort of discuss the aspects that I talked about just now in the context of transition metal oxides and oxide heterostructures. So this is, I should acknowledge my collaborators, this is work done with two of my PhD students, Ashley Cook, who's now moving to the University of Zurich to Titus Neupert's group there, and Kiran Hickey, who's in the final year of his PhD at Toronto. We benefited a lot from collaborations with a colleague of mine, Yongjun Kim, who does neutron scattering on a number of these oxide materials, and similarly a neutron group at Oak Ridge. And recently we've had a very productive collaboration with Tanushree Sadas Gupta, who's been doing some of these density functional calculations that I'll touch upon later in the talk. All right, so how do we think about the two aspects of the physics that we want to kind of put together? One is, if we want to think about strong correlation physics, many of the people in this room have made very, very important contributions to sort of really understanding in very great detail the physics of what happens when we take oxides of 3D transition metals, where the physics of strong correlation sort of pushes you either to the brink of MOT localization or sort of deep into a MOT insulating phase. Okay? And in these cases, the kinetic energy and interaction sort of play a comparable role. And one typically finds, as I already mentioned, very high energy and temperature scales for various physics, including magnetism, which is important for us. If we, on the other hand, want to think about topological phases, as I already mentioned, in particular the quantum anomalous Hall effect, one is interested in sort of pushing up the scale of spin-orbit interactions, which means sort of going down the periodic table here. Typically, this also means weakening correlations, and so one would want to sort of ask, how do I kind of marry strong correlations and spin-orbit if they seem to be naturally occurring in different parts of this periodic table? Okay? And so there are two ways people have kind of gone about this. One is to try and make oxides of complex oxides of these 5D transition metals. And the observation that was made in this very important seminal paper is that what you really need for strong correlations is narrow bands. And we don't really care where these narrow bands come from. So if you have a 3D transition metal oxide, then in particular the D bands are already narrow to begin with. But if we think about 5D oxides, the bands are a priori not narrow. But what spin-orbit coupling does is that you start off with this, you know, big set of bands, and it progressively chops you up where, you know, you get this chopping up of the bandwidth because of crystal field effects, where we are focused on the sort of T2G level of the crystal fields. But then what spin-orbit coupling does, which is important in these 5D oxides, is further chops up these bands into a state with total angular momentum 1/2 and total angular momentum 3/2. Okay, so this can give you one, this is one route to getting narrow bands. You just take some big fat band and you keep chopping it up into little pieces such that even though interactions are weaker, they can still give you some interesting physics. Second way, which is sort of again pioneered by a number of people listed here, is is that you can try and make heterostructures of oxide. So you can sort of use MB or laser deposition to sort of come in with one layer of atoms of one type, and you can sort of grow layers of different transition elements one on top of the other. And this has been done now for a number of systems. Of course, it started off, and the most famous one is this LAO-STO interface where people found superconductivity and magnetism. But there has been a lot of effort and work recently in growing superlattices or heterostructures going along the 1-1-1 direction. Okay? So that's the direction that I'll talk about later in the talk. So this is you're going along the cubic 1-1-1 axis along the cube diagonal. And people have made superlattices of things like nickelate manganate superlattices. So these are both 3D transition metals. But more recently, there's been work from Hide Takagi's group making superlattices with titanates and iridates. So again, mixing sort of 3D and 5D transition elements here. Similarly here, this is one with iron chromium. So again, both 3D. And one can also make quantum wells by trying to put sandwich something interesting, phases between sort of more band insulator type phases. Okay.
Just a question. Mm-hmm. So, although spin orbit is definitely important for LAO-STO, there's no real topological phases there that I know of, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. So, it's important in the sense that you break inversion symmetry, and definitely people have seen signatures of a field tunable Raspa effect at the interface. So one of the things that kind of spurred us on was these experimental developments over the last 2-3 years. But people had also studied simple monolayer bilayer structures of simple transition metal oxides. And the point is, in some of these cases, you do find some topological insulator phases. So these are time reversal, mostly time reversal invariant topological insulators that people have been trying to look for in models of such oxide heterostructures. And I'll touch upon this. I'll sort of come to where this comes from, but the basic ingredient is that if you go along the 1-1-1 direction and you make a bilayer, you end up with basically a honeycomb-like structure of transition elements. And now the physics becomes somewhat similar to graphene schematically, in the sense you have some graphene-like dispersion with Dirac points that breaking inversion sort of, or breaking or putting in spin orbit can gap out. Okay, so that's the basic picture that is used in these kinds of building blocks to think about topological insulators. Okay. So the things that I'll talk about today are what are called double perovskites. And these are systems where, even in bulk, these kinds of dual things appear naturally. So these have the chemical formula A2BB'O6. So it's like ABO3, AB'O3. So two different perovskites which are put together. And the ones that we are interested in are what are called ordered double perovskites, which have this checkerboard ordering of two different types of transition elements in the simple cubic perovskite structure. Okay. And broadly speaking, they'll fall into two categories. One, there's a whole bunch of bulk double perovskites that have been known for many years now. And they fall into one class, which are metallic systems, and a lot of them tend to be half-metallic ferromagnets with an extremely large spin polarization, or nearly complete spin polarization, which means that if you want to think about doing experiments where you want to inject spin and do experiments where you try to apply spin torques and things like that, these are sort of interesting candidate materials to think about. Okay. There are other cases where you get MOT insulating double perovskites, where again correlation effects are strong, but most importantly, only one of these two, the purple or the yellow sublattice, is actually electronically active. The other one is completely inert. So for example, if you think about the barium yttrium rhenium oxide, yttrium is completely inert, so one of the sublattices gets knocked out of the problem. And so there's only one sublattice left, and so what we have are MOT insulators on some FCC lattice. Okay? And the reason they're MOT insulators typically is because the distance between the remaining atoms is much bigger than it was before. Okay? And so correlations tend to be stronger than the bandwidth. And so again, there are a number of these examples that are known, and one can start thinking about the physics of both metallic as well as itinerant as well as these kind of MOT insulating phases. If we think about these double perovskites, which are ordered, this kind of ordered double perovskites, you see from here that if we go along the 1-1-1 direction, there is this natural stacking of, you know, type B and B prime going along the cubic 1-1-1 axis. So what people have done, which I showed in some of the references in the previous view graph, is to really build these double perovskites by sort of growing them along the 1-1-1 direction. So that's the cleanest way to actually get thin films of these double perovskite materials. Of course, you can't sort of get a very, very thick film, but if you want to think about few layers, then it's sort of a nice way to get it. Okay. Typically in bulk, it's very hard to make single crystals, so people have either small single crystals or powder systems, but to grow very clean thin films, this seems to be a possibility. Okay. So by the way, so just feel free to stop and ask questions. I'm going on. Okay. So, So if you think about the physics of these systems, we have to put together two ingredients now. So we have two types of transition elements. So if you think about the physics at the level of a single atom for one of these, so let's think about the iron-based double perovskites. Then iron here is in a 3+ configuration, and it has 5d electrons which lock into a very big magnetic moment with spin 5½. If it was chromium, in some cases you get sort of chromium, you get similarly, you'll get a spin 3½ for the chromium system. But basically the role of one of these ions here is typically to give you some big giant magnetic moment. Okay. The second element here, you know, molybdenum or rhenium, basically involves one or two electrons sitting in the T2g orbital of a 4d, or for rhenium a 5d orbital. And so this has a spin orbit coupling ingredient. Okay, so what we want to do is to put together these two ingredients just living on two different atoms now. So we have spin orbit coupling from one of them and large magnetism on the other one. Okay,
and
so that's
the reason why the relative spin configurations of the two sites is mostly antiferromagnetic.
Yeah.
Is because they live in the T2g shell, right? It's this guy lives in the T2g shell.
Yeah.
So it's really very different from a double exchange system.
Yeah. So I'll come to that as well in a second. Yeah. So if you think about just the atomic physics here, then the only, if you just have a D1 system, the only thing that matters is what else that have we left out of the single particle problem. And what we've left out here so what we've left out here is the fact that the T2g orbitals act like an effective angular momentum 1 system, and so you can have spin orbit coupling that's effective there and splits you up into a manifold of j equal to 3½ and j equal to 1/2 states, as I mentioned earlier. If you think about rhenium, if you think about rhenium, then there are two electrons sitting on the rhenium, which means not only do we have to account for spin orbit coupling, we should also worry about what happens with interactions in this T2g manifold. So in this case, we have to keep interaction effects on the side, and they're important. Okay. So what's the origin of the half metallicity in bulk? Okay. So in the bulk systems, and it'll also turn out to be true when we talk about thin films in a second, the reason these are half metallic is that on iron, we have a big local moment where all electrons are kind of locked into this giant, almost classical spin. So the itinerant electrons are mainly coming from the molybdenum or the rhenium. Okay? And so what's happening is that this molybdenum electron wants to move around on this lattice, but the best way for it to do that is to actually hop onto an iron site. But if it tries to come here, it cannot actually be pointing in the up direction. It can only point in the down direction. Okay? So there's only one way for this electron to land here. That is when it's pointing opposite to the existing local moment on the iron side. Okay? So this is opposite from the manganites, as Antwa mentioned, where because of Hund's coupling, they're forced to be parallel to one another because we have both T2g and Eg being active, giving you the two fluids in the problem. Okay? Now, if the iron moments are completely pointing in random directions, then much like in the manganites, the motion of these electrons, itinerant carriers, is frustrated. But if all the iron moments line up and point in the same direction, then these itinerant electrons can maximally delocalize. Okay? So that's what gives rise to, you know, a kinetic energy driven mechanism for making sure that these ion moments tend to order ferromagnetically. And this will be true in bulk, it will also be true in the thin film. So we can put together, you know, this ingredient. So if you imagine that the ion moments order in some direction, we can ask, well, can we sort of capture the band structure from more complete ab initio calculations? Because of course this is just a toy picture where we said, well, there's some classical moment and then there are some conduction electrons. There's really no such separation between, clear separation between localized and itinerant degrees of freedom. But if we try and compare the kind of band structures that one gets from this kind of simplified picture, then at least we can reproduce. So this is for a different system. This is for rhenium. So we've kept at least Hartree level interactions between these electrons. So we've sort of kept the Kanamori interaction, but then just did this very, very simple mean field theory in the Hartree channel. And what that leaves us with is a band structure for red being spin down, blue being spin up. And the band structure kind of resembles what one gets from complete ab initio calculations here. Okay. So here the LDA plus U sort of takes into account this, you know, Hartree level kind of correlations are taken into account in both pictures. And what that does is it's important to repel the up rhenium states away from the down rhenium states in energy and sort of give you this half metal that has only a single spin channel active at the Fermi level.
So Arun, just to make sure I understand, so the right-hand side is LDA plus U.
Yeah.
The left-hand side is some tight binding.
It's just tight binding plus mean field, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so of course we are not able to, you know, so it just involves putting in some tight binding parameters in the model. So what we've done is just put in some, you know, very, very few parameters, you know, first neighbor, second neighbor hopping. And the main thing we've tried to capture is the broad sort of, you know, structure of these bands. But of course you see that, you know, we are not capturing, you know, all the precise details of the nature of these bands very, very close to the Fermi level are not precisely captured, but, you know, one can do a better job. No, this U is on a rhenium. Iron in this case, sorry. So this is in the LDA plus U, they have put in a value which is similar on rhenium. Yeah, so on iron, I think it's much bigger in the LDA. Here, the iron is just a classical local moment, so we don't have to put in anything on the iron at all. We've just assumed that it's totally locked. And so this U in the model calculation is only on the rhenium. And this delta here represents the fact that because there are two different elements, there is an energy offset, and the energy offset is about an electron volt between being on the rhenium versus being on the iron.
Okay. So in the time binding calculation on top of the U on the rhenium, mm-hmm. which is treated Hartree light, mm-hmm. there is also a vice field, a big vice field, which comes from the iron moment.
Yeah, so that will come, well, it's not a vice field
but
from
the...
There is a vice field on the ion site, yeah. Yeah. But basically what we're doing is just using that more or less like a projection, right? So it's like an infinite vice field, if you will, that only forces the down electrons.
So at the end of the day, you calculate the structure of down electrons
on. That's right. So only the down, well, the up electrons are there, but they're just pushed away from the Fermi level. The up electrons only move on the rhenium. The down electrons are, you know, it's mostly rhenium, but it'll have a little bit of ion contribution. So it's hybridized here. The rhenium on the up electrons are purely rhenium in this model. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So one can show that, you know, if you don't take into account these Hartree level correlations, then of course you don't get a half metal, but you also don't recover sort of a big moment on the rhenium side, which is kind of, you know, to be expected with you. So once you include that, you sort of get the fact that, you know, you have a big ion moment, but you also have a big down moment on the rhenium, and it's the cancellation between these two that gives rise to the net magnetic moment in this ferromagnet. Okay, so it's sort of more like a ferry magnet if you think in a local moment picture. Okay, so what about, on the other hand, we can say, well, okay, that was the kind of more itinerant perspective, but these are probably at some intermediate correlation regime. So if we start from the local atomic problem and sort of crank up interactions, with these D2, then you would say, well, I just want to diagonalize this interaction Hamiltonian, and really because the number of particles is fixed, the only scale that enters here is the Hund's coupling, right? And so if we do this, then the eigenstate sort of evolve from something where you just put independent particles into these levels. So you could put, for example, you know, if you want to put two particles, you can sort of put them in many ways. So here, for instance, the blue level here corresponds to putting both particles in the same state. And so there's sort of, you know, six ways to do that here. So there's some degeneracy of six for this level. Or you take, you know, one particle here and one particle there, or you put both of them there, and that's that. Okay. But of course, once you start cranking up the Hund's coupling, the system, the eigenstates evolve, and at fairly large Hund's coupling of order twice the spin orbit, one can really think of these more in terms of total angular momentum states, where there's a total L equal to 1 and a total S equal to 1 that locks to form an effective J equal to 2 state out here. Okay. So the reality is probably somewhere in between these two. Okay. But let me sort of sketch, I mean, just like I showed that the itinerant picture sort of captures some aspects of the band structure from ab initio, I just want to sort of mention that the local moment kind of perspective gives us some handle on the neutron scattering experiments that have been done in the bulk system. Okay. So this is elastic neutron scattering spectrum showing you sort of, this is just the Bragg peak associated with the crystal structure. But once you cool below the magnetic ordering temperature, there is a Bragg peak at pi, pi, pi in this perovskite notation, which corresponds to anti-parallel ordering of the iron and rhenium moments, and that kind of starts picking up. In the inelastic spectrum, there is this very clear signature of two peaks that emerge at low temperature. Okay. And so one can sort of ask, you know, where do these two come from? And basically, these are the fluctuations of an anti-ferromagnet or like a ferrimagnet with two different local moments on the two sublattices. And that local moment picture, one can very easily sort of work out what the dynamic structure factor looks like. And this is sort of the experimental data, and that's sort of the theoretical calculations in that very simple model. And that reproduces sort of this low energy, you know, nearly gapless mode, but also sort of gives you these higher energy two modes that are seen in the neutron scattering spectrum. So this gives us sort of a handle on what the kind of exchange scale is between the neighboring iron and rhenium moments in this picture, and it's on the scale of about 3 millivolts, which roughly gives you the correct, you know, magnitude for TC. Okay. So once we know sort of some aspects of the bulk physics, what we want to now ask is the question of what happens if you take systems like this and just thin them down to the very, very thin film limit, and in particular here, I'll just talk about a single bilayer along the 1-1-1 direction. Okay, so this is just taking one slice of one of these triangular layers of one element and one triangular layer of the other element, and with AB stacking one on top of the other. Okay, so this bilayer has this buckled honeycomb lattice structure that I mentioned already, and so the purple rhenium atoms here form a triangular lattice, and sitting on top of them in the way I've shown it here are iron atoms, and these iron atoms have giant local moments that prefer to line up along a single direction, and in this case it turns out that the direction is perpendicular to the 1-1-1 plane. Okay, so it's going basically pointing along the 1-1-1 direction, so it's normal to the plane, and the iron atoms basically point in that direction, so coming out of the slide in this case. Okay. So what's the band structure of these things? Okay. So these are half metals, and density functional theory calculations, and I'll show you just a picture of the bands from there. But basically, these are these continue to be half metals. So all the spin states within, so if we exclude spin orbit coupling, all the spin states near the Fermi level, you know, within about half an electron volt of the Fermi level, are completely spin polarized. But what is important to take into account is the fact that unlike the cubic structure that I was talking about, here, because these are in thin film structure, and in particular because we have sliced it off at some point, they have very, very strong trigonal distortions. This is sort of squeezing the, you know, you can think of squeezing the octahedra along the 1-1-1, or, you know, pulling down the octahedra along the 1-1-1 direction. Okay. And what that does is it takes this T2G and further splits it into two levels, one of which in this, so I'm not talking now, so this labels here that I'll give these orbitals are in this global axis where Z is coming out of the board and the XY axes are pointing into the board. So then this is not in the octahedral cubic axis. But this trigonal splitting splits you into a doublet of states, which you can think of as having angular momentum projection this, along the Z direction being plus or minus 2, which are this dx square minus y square plus or minus I dxy. And the higher energy state, which is the 3z square minus r square. And we know that from band structure calculations that I'll mention, but basically it looks like there is an isolated state near the gamma point that's up in energy, which is roughly that, and a doublet here, which is this doublet. Okay. So this is a non-Kramer's doublet because, of course, you know, these are not, you might think it's just time reversal symmetry that's protecting them based on what I've written here, but of course, it's the precise structure of the crystal fields that's holding them at the same energy. So crystal symmetry is important as well.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just confused about one thing. Usually, yeah. We think of T2G as having an effective L equal 1.
Yeah.
But when you write the Kanamori Hamiltonian as you did before, L is really 1. So the three states would have 0 plus or minus 1. So what's going on now?
So here I'm just, okay, so here I'm just using what the phase of the wave function would be, and it winds by.
So the L operator, which is there, which is plus or minus 2, is not the one that I would put into the Kanamori local Hamiltonian.
No, it would be that, but I think I'm just talking about what are the states that you project out from the full 5D problem. So if I talk about the angular momentum, the full angular momentum channel, and I ask about how the phase of the wave function.
So this L
This L is from the full, yeah. This, yeah, yeah, this L is from the full
T-shell.
No, no, this is not the effective. No, no, no. Yeah. So this is just the full T2G, and I'm just using it to ask how the wave function winds around with you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the L equal to plus minus 1 are kind of knocked out of the picture, which is the EG in this case. Yeah, so it's not, so I've not projected to the T2G. So now we can sort of think about this, right? So far I've not even talked about interactions in this picture. Yeah, that's right. So this is a non-Kramer's doublet, and now one can ask, well, how does this non-Kramer's doublet basically hop around? Okay. So for a moment, let's completely forget about this isolated 3z square. All the interesting physics actually turns out to be in this doublet of states here. So this is a non-Kramer's doublet, and it states with, you know, it's useful to think in terms of states with well-defined angular momentum, which means the wave function sort of looks like, you know, particle going on a ring, where the phase winds by 4 pi when you go around once, okay? So going from, so these colors are sort of schematic representation of how the phase winds as you go around the circle. So you go from, for one of them, you go from red to yellow to blue for the three bond directions on the triangular lattice. For the other state, for the minus state, you go from red to blue to yellow. So you sort of wind in the opposite sense for these two angular momentum wave functions. For the z square, it's kind of featureless. There is no directionality. But now if you think about hopping between these states with well-defined angular momentum LZ, then we see that if you want to hop between two states of the same type, so let's say plus going to plus, then it turns out that the same phase always sort of points towards each other, right? So if you go here, the yellow points to yellow, red points to red, so all the phases are basically real. But if you think about the hopping between the two orbitals, let's say from plus going to minus, then depending on direction, the red might point to red, or the red blue might point to yellow. So in fact, the phase of the hopping is tied to sort of the bond direction. Okay? So when you go around by 2 pi in real space, the phase of the hopping basically winds by 4 pi for the same reason that this wave function sort of winds by 4 pi. Okay. So what this gives us is then a dispersion for these two orbitals, just now focusing on the rhenium layer, which forms a triangular lattice. You have these two orbitals that have this dispersion here, where this band touching here is guaranteed by crystal symmetry and time reversal. And then there is a Dirac point at the corners of the hexagonal Brillouin zone here, and this is protected by time reversal and inversion symmetry. Okay, so time reversal here, I'm referring to time reversal for spinless fermions. So effectively, I complex conjugate everything and send k to minus k. Okay, I'm not doing anything with the spin of the system. the spin stays frozen in the problem. So these are just spinless fermions. So if now we start with this, right? It's very hard to imagine getting anything like a quantum anomalous Hall insulator simply because, you know, even if I were to gap it out with spin orbit coupling, which I'll show in a second, you can't put the chemical potential in the gap. Okay? There is no full gap in the problem. These are highly dispersing bands. But it turns out there is actually another important effect coming from the fact that inversion symmetry is really broken in the problem because of this underlying or, you know, ion layer that's above. And what that does, it gaps out the Dirac point here at the K point of this spectrum. Okay. So schematically, again, if you want to think about, you know, what's the origin of the splitting, right? Really, you should think about what these wave functions look like. So if you have, you know, circular wave functions, then the probability density at around a site, let's say I have some orbital localized on site 1 or site 2, the probability density is just going to be sort of circular around that point. But now what we want to do is to put, you know, imagine a particle now that's allowed to hop from site to site, and imagine we want to superpose these to form some kind of block state. Okay? So if we form a block state with momentum 0, then in this two-site problem, roughly what we're doing is superposing the two circles with each other and then computing what the probability density looks like, and that's completely nice and symmetric. But if we set it in motion, so if we take two of these wave functions and overlap them with a relative phase, which means, you know, take these two colored circles and sort of twist them around by an amount that's equal to the momentum one way or the other for positive and negative momentum, then if we overlap, then the probability density immediately breaks the y to minus y symmetry. Okay. So what this tells you is that, you know, these block states that are moving in certain directions carry with them some, in this case, if I'm moving in a one-dimensional system along the x direction, they will produce for me an electric dipole moment that points along plus y or minus y. And these electric dipoles can couple to any electric fields that are present in the problem because of breaking of inversion symmetry. Okay. So here, the breaking of inversion symmetry is coming from the underlying ion layer, and so it's going to produce for you, for instance, electric fields that might point outward or inward on certain triangles, let's say the up triangles here. And these electric fields can couple to these dipole moments, okay? And that will be the sort of the new dispersion. That will be the change coming from the inversion symmetry breaking. And what that does is it gaps out the Dirac point in the spectrum here. And now we see that without spin orbit coupling, we are left with a half semi-metal. So it's a half metal that we started with. So all spins are polarized. It's a semi-metal in the sense that the density of states is that there are no, you know, there are states at the Fermi level only come from points in momentum space, discrete points in momentum space. In particular here, it's just at the gamma point. So the density of states is finite because we are in two dimensions, but it's a semi-metal in the sense that there are points rather than having a full Fermi surface. We only have Fermi points in the problem. Okay. So what we want to do now is to ask, you know, if I take this problem, it has a quadratic band touching at the gamma point. Can I gap it out with spin orbit coupling and get something interesting? So here is just a schematic of what I showed earlier. This is the sort of naive band structure on the triangular lattice. If we incorporate inversion breaking, it gives us that. Okay? And what spin orbit coupling does is it breaks time reversal as well, and that gaps out this point here at the gamma point. So what we are left with is a single band that lies below the Fermi level, and it turns out this band has a Chern number, non-zero Chern number. In particular, here it's Chern number plus or minus one, depending on the sign of the magnetization. And so this just shows that, you know, if you compute the Berry curvature, it's peaked slightly away from the gamma point because you've gone slightly away from the quadratic band touching Hamiltonian. Okay. And one can use, you know, this film geometry to compute what the magnetic interactions are and estimate a TC, and it's, you know, reasonably high. So the gaps are pretty big, the TC is pretty high, and the hope is that one can then realize this quantum Hall physics at elevated temperatures. Okay. All right. So if there are any questions about this, I'm going to switch gear in the next few minutes just to talk about a slightly different aspect of the story. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can I say that this distortion is of the order of 400 milli electron volts? And you say said that this is just due to the confinement, basically, of a 1-1-1 with Western, right?
Not typical, yeah. So this is because in this case, the confinement is also such that so there is a certain termination layer here. It's not like taking a bulk and doing trigonal distortions. We are sort of chopping off the layer at some point, okay? And what that does is it gives on the, in this case, the ion is the one above, and it turns out that the ion in this case has an extremely strong trigonal distortion. So it gets imprinted on the rhenium states, but it's coming from the fact that unlike in bulk crystals, where I guess it would be on the scale of, you know, 50 millivolts or something, here it's enormous. Right. So in this case, no. So the orbital Rajba is mainly coming from breaking mirror symmetries in the plane. So it's really coming not because of, so the usual Rajba, I mean, is because you have electric fields perpendicular to the like you break Z to minus Z inversion. Here, most of the Rajba that I'm talking about is, I mean, it's Rajba in the sense it's, you know, electric field induced, but the symmetry breaking is sort of in the plane. So most of the components, so if you think about the ion layers being above below, they will both break mirror symmetries as well as, you know, the Z inversion. And so the mirror breaking is the one that turns out to be more important here. Yeah? Next thing? Yeah. This?
So in the left figure, I think the spin of it coupling does not mix the state between G scale and another state.
No, so here I have, no, so here right now I've just omitted it for now. So if you do the full band structure, it turns out there will be mixing and splitting, but it just doesn't matter for the physics that I'm talking about here, so I've not kept it in the simplified picture. Yeah. So right now I'm just talking about this doublet, which is this blue states, and everything that I've said, you know, changes very little once we include the hybridization between these two. So you're right that there are crossing points here that do get gapped out as well, but that doesn't change the physics of what I just said. Yeah, question.
So coming back to the previous slide.
This one?
Just one before. Yeah, this one. Mm-hmm. So here on the bottom here, so because these two states are degenerate, mm-hmm. So they are going to order like in a like honeycomb lattice, like each minor state will be surrounded by plus states and vice versa.
No. So this is not orbital order yet. I just have, you know, I have degenerate states and I'm just looking at itinerant electron dispersion. So when the electrons move around, these orbitals will get scrambled, right? So these orbitals here are not simply plus minus, so they're not localized.
So what you're drawing here is actually different configurations for the hopping amplitudes.
That's right, that's all, yeah. Yeah, so I'm not trying to show, sorry. I was not trying to show any ordering of these. Sorry, it's just that if you have these orbitals, what are the hopping processes? That's right. Sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's plotted here. Yeah. Okay. So the next few minutes, like 5 minutes, is it okay?
Oh,
I see. Okay. 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 So. Sure, okay. So what I wanted to touch upon is a sort of another ingredient here, which is, you know, if you think about quantum phase transitions in various systems, if you think about, for instance, insulating states like magnetic states, Mott insulating states that, let's say, undergo phase transitions between, insulating featureless paramagnets to magnetically ordered states, for example, that happens in some of these, a lot of these spin dimer compounds, either via pressure or induced by a magnetic field in this case, then we sort of understand that, you know, there's some certain quantum critical point that separates sort of disordered phases from ordered phases, and that in some cases, depending on dimensionality, one will have an ordered phase with a finite transition temperature. Okay? So then you end up with this picture where you have some tuning parameter in general that takes you between two different an ordered phase and a disordered phase, and there is a quantum critical fan around this point where at finite temperature you somehow sense this underlying singularity. If you think about metallic systems, of course, this is usually not what happens. Okay? So what happens typically is that you get phase transition, let's say here between some kind of a spin density wave metal or an antiferromagnetic metal here to some kind of a Fermi liquid, and we hope that by driving field or pressure or doping, we are sort of going to go nicely through a quantum critical point. But very often, of course, that's not what happens. What happens most often is that there is some new phase that emerges and kind of covers the critical point that you thought might exist there. Okay? So in this case, there is some kind of small dome of superconductivity here in this heavy fermion system. Here, there is a superconducting state coming out of a charge density wave, whether you drive it by pressure or by intercalating with copper, which effectively sort of dopes the system. Okay? So somehow it must be that when you get very, very close to this quantum critical point, the Fermi surface sort of hates these fluctuations, and it sort of reorganizes in some way to give you new phases in the vicinity of such critical points. So the question is, what happens at topological critical points? And the ones that I'm sort of interested in are where there is some feature of this kind of metallic density of states that will be present at the quantum critical point in the problem. Okay. So it turns out that if we think about it, this kind of problem came up because we were thinking about some models, again, of these kinds of double perovskite films, where there are some cases where you get a phase transition between a quantum anomalous Hall insulator with churn number 2, so sigma xy being 2 e square over h, to an ordinary insulator which is topologically trivial. And when we ask, and there is some tuning parameter in this case, there was some combination of trigonal distortions and some hoppings, that takes you through a direct transition between them. Okay. And the reason this kind of a direct transition is allowed, it turns out, is that right at the critical point, there's a quadratic band touching that appears in this problem. Which is associated with, you can think of this as two Dirac points having merged. And so your churn number then can change by 2 as opposed to the usual change of churn number by 1. Okay. So this quadratic band touching point is the quantum critical point. It's metallic in the sense that although there is a single Fermi point here, because it's parabolic dispersion in 2 dimensions, the density of states is still finite. Okay. So this is the simplest analog of the examples I was giving earlier. There's a single point on the Fermi surface, if you will, and somehow it's trying to go through a transition. This Fermi point appears, and then this Fermi point doesn't like what's happening to it. Okay. And so one can sort of ask what happens to this picture once interactions are turned on. Okay. And in this case, the interaction, as you see, is there are just two states in some way. So you can think of this as pseudo spin, up and down. And so there is a single interaction that you can sort of add to this problem. So there's a single coupling. And so what happens is that this coupling basically runs off to infinity. Okay. So the way you can think about this is if I take an insulator, it has a band gap. It's a band insulator. It's topologically non-trivial, but who cares, right? So it's just an insulator with a gap, and so interactions don't do anything here. That's a trivial insulator. Again, interactions don't do anything so long as they are weak. But if you get right to the critical point, then even if interactions are weak, they are marginally relevant. Okay. So what's going to happen at a fixed interaction is that you're going to be stable, stable, stable. Then there will be some window where you destabilize this quadratic band touching point, and then again you come back to a stable regime. So if one works out what the precise instability is towards, it turns out it's towards a state that's actually a nematic that breaks the rotational symmetry associated with this quadratic band touching point. And so the naive expectation was this single quantum critical point between two different quantum Hall states with some crossover that one can draw, which tells you how fast the Hall conductance changes going from left to right. But in reality, it turns out that there is a dome of nematic order that emerges that kind of covers this underlying quantum critical point. Okay? So in some ways, this gives you a playing ground. These kind of quadratic band touchings turn out to be fairly ubiquitous when one thinks about these models of quantum anomalous Hall insulators. It turns out that there are a lot of systems where we find that when we actually do. So for instance, in the previous case that I talked about, there is a quadratic band touching point at the gamma point here, which again, interactions will kind of destabilize it. In this case, it was a different context, a different critical point, but nevertheless, we find this quadratic band touching protected by symmetry. Okay, so it turns out that one can sort of get interesting phases at the vicinity of these topological transitions. So let me skip over this. This was just just a line about this. We've also worked a bit on these topological, Morton slaters of these kinds of iridate double perovskites in this particular case. And it turns out that one can sort of understand some aspects of this kind of gapped magnetic excitation spectrum in these bulk systems in terms of some underlying Kitaev interaction between these spins. And so in particular, let me skip all this. Okay. So it turns out that in these cases, you have Morton slaters where you can have interesting magnetic interactions, which we know in some cases can give you topological like spin liquid type phases in two dimensions. And in particular, one can imagine starting with these materials which in bulk are known to host Kitaev interactions in bulk crystals and imagine actually growing them in a very similar way as I talked about earlier. And that way sort of realizing various two-dimensional lattices. And in some cases, one can get interesting quantum spin liquids or topological order in them. Okay? So let me not sort of go into it. If people are interested, we can sort of discuss it later. But thank you for your attention. Which one?
If I have a wide phase between two topological and non-trivial insulator, mm-hmm. the interaction will render it unstable.
No, so while points are more. No, so here it's different because this is a two-dimensional system with a quadratic band touching, so the density of states is finite. Right, for the while. It's not a while, yeah. So typically you would. Typically you might get isolated Dirac points, which even in two dimensions would be fine. And in three dimensions, it's even more stable.
Okay.
Yeah, so while points are more stable than this. Yeah.
Okay. So it's a question of dimensionality.
Dimensionality and the fact that the dispersion is quadratic here, as opposed to linear. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. More questions? Well, I will have to ask you about the Luttinger-Tisha phase that you
mm-hmm.
saw.
Yeah.
But maybe we can do that.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I see. And no, I didn't.
Any more questions? Yes.
Yeah.
So maybe I didn't understand the pneumatic order.
Yeah.
Because your Fermi surface is 2 points.
No, it's just a single point.
Okay, just a single point. So,
yeah.
But, I mean, there is no anisotropy in the Fermi surface.
Right. So it's not that's right. So it's not an anisotropy of the Fermi surface, but what I said earlier was you can think of quadratic band touching as two Dirac points in some sense having merged, right? And you can ask, well, why do they stay together, right? Why do you get a quadratic band touching in the first place, right? And it turns out it's protected by symmetries in the problem. Okay, so because you have certain crystal symmetries, you can't split this quadratic band touching into two Dirac points, which would have been the minimal, vorticity that you could have got, right? So if you want to do this, so what happens because of interactions is it spontaneously breaks the symmetry. It says, well, you will take this quadratic band touching and split it into two Dirac points, but you have three ways in which you can do this in this particular crystal. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the phases you get are ones where quantum Hall effect coexists with pneumatic order. So you can have coexistence of the topological phase together with the symmetry breaking. sigma xx will be anisotropic, but sigma xy is quantized. Right. So, and if you look at things like, you know, temperature dependence, then of course there will be, you know, different temperature dependence to the resistivities. Yeah. So response functions are anisotropic, but the quantization of the Hall is precise. So I think the analogs, I mean, the closest analogs I can think of in real systems where some of this may have been seen is in the context of these, you know, higher half-filled Landau levels, where I think in the nine half, I think there is reports that of some kind of symmetry breaking.
Is that from STM measurements?
This is from, no, not from STM. I think this is transport measurements. I think it's transport, yeah. Transport.
Yeah, I thought also Yazani had imaged some anisotropy by not exactly STM, similar technique, microscopy, local pore.
Yeah. This one.
Can you call it orbital polarization? And the fact that you, have this, you talk about these dipole interacting with the HP, the fact that you've taken it into account before in your model changes somehow all the discussion.
Right. So in the beginning, I did not. Right. So in the beginning, I did not take into account the inversion symmetry breaking.
Yes.
Right. But my block states do carry dipole moments, right? They do have some polarization.
So it means that it's important how you include the effect of the electric field in your type bound, in your model.
Right. So in the model right now, I have only included it as an inversion symmetry breaking term, but we can sort of guess the form exactly like for Zyloshinsky-Moria or Rashba interactions. It turns out there's a very precise, you know, this gives you a way to figure out what's going to happen because you know the direction of the dipole moment and you know that when you hop to the right, you will get one sign and when you hop backwards, you'll get the opposite sign.
Yes.
So you know that it's a term that is odd in momentum,
yes.
Right? So in one dimension, it just goes like sine of kx,
yes,
times the, in this case, it's just sigma z, where for one orbital, let's say the angular momentum positive orbital, it'll be, you know, positive, and for orbital momentum negative, it'll be negative.
But is there a good way to, it looks like you have both ways, and one is good and one is wrong, so.
Oh, you mean this one?
It's just,
sorry.
When you make the calculation,
no, so here it's not been included. That's the problem,
yes, okay.
Right?
But then you have two ways of, and depending on, then.
Oh, this versus this?
Yes, this SOC, what?
Oh, no, sorry. So I didn't explain this. So this is what happens if you just turn on spin-orbit coupling.
Yeah, but what spin-orbit coupling?
So spin-orbit coupling here, okay. So spin-orbit coupling is the original L dot S,
yes,
right?
The atomic spin-orbit.
Sorry, so it's not the so this orbital Rashba here is not relativistic, right? This is just coming from interaction of electric fields with dipoles, right? So that's just a non-relativistic effect. Here I'm talking of just the usual relativistic atomic spin-orbit coupling.
And so what you're saying is that if you add first orbital and then add the Rashba, add the spin-orbit coupling orbital.
Yeah, or you could do this. It doesn't matter how you. I mean, it's just that if you just add spin-orbit coupling, you don't get insulator. You get a metallic phase.
Okay.
And so, but if once you add inversion symmetry breaking,
okay,
you see that in fact you can get the right physics.
Okay.
Right. So the order, of course.
Which order you do?
No, it doesn't matter. No. It's just for the explanation. If you just add spin-orbit, you would not end up in the right phase. But if you remember that there is inversion symmetry breaking, then you see why you get this. You get a semi-metal, which then gets gapped out. You could do it from here too, but then it would be less evident as to, you know, which is the important ingredient. Here the important ingredient is that inversion symmetry breaking was key to actually gapping out this K point.
And if you add an electric field on top of all of this,
oh,
what happens?
Perpendicular, you mean?
Yeah, you apply electric field in the where do you, because you will polarize your wave function and you, so where does it enter in all of
So if you apply an external electric field perpendicular to the system, then here nothing is going to change here.
Yeah.
In the non-relativistic limit, nothing is going to change. In the relativistic case, you will get sort of the real Rashba interaction. But here, because the spins are locked to be perpendicular to the axis, you won't see that until you get to some critical value of the electric field. Then you probably want to tip the spins in the plane and have them spiral or do something.
So it's also negligible for the orbital Rashba?
Which one?
It
will not, because here the important thing that's breaking is the breaking of, like I said earlier, it's the breaking of mirror symmetry in the plane. Because the fact that you have electric fields, they are three-dimensional electric fields, so they have a component in plane and they have a component out of plane. So the in-plane component is what was important here. Yeah, so the out-of-plane component is not playing a role, much of a role. Yeah. Right, so I think it's a little. So spin orbit coupling is much smaller. So in principle, you may not sort of get the physics that occurs here. But more importantly, I think it's important to have a regime where. So here is the problem. So imagine you just take a single type of perovskite, right? And now you want to crank up correlations to drive it into a magnetic phase. Then if correlations are too weak, you will not get magnetism. If correlations are too strong, you sort of push it into a Mott insulator, right? So in a lot of the systems based on single perovskites, it's a little more delicate to sort of stabilize these phases because you have to be right at the brink of being neither delocalized nor completely localized. And so that's, so for instance, even if one looks at three-dimensional, the Weyl semi-metals that people have done with the calculations for with the iridate pyrochlores, again, there it happens if you look at the phase diagram, it turns out there is a small sliver where, you know, you go from something where you have some kind of quadratic band touching at the gamma point in the pyrochlore iridates, and the system stays stable, you know, up to some point. And then for very large interactions, you get this all-in-all-out magnetic order. But the Weyl semi-metal, for instance, there is a very, very small sliver in the phase diagram. So it's typically an issue with, if you take single perovskites, that's the typical issue.